My guest today is Jill Escher. Jill is a philanthropist focused on autism research, a lawyer, and a mother of two autistic children. More accurately, they are now young adults. Jill is the president of the National Council on Severe Autism and a former president and current board member of the Autism Society, San Francisco Bay Area. Through her work with the Escher Fund for Autism, Jill leads innovative research investigating the causes of autism. Her research enhances our understanding and pushes the boundaries of what we know about autism. One example Jill explains during the episode involves research on germ cells. The ability to question and expand research allows us to explore new regions of interest for understanding the causes of the autistic phenotype. Please see the show notes for links to Jill's work and her research. In addition, there are resources from previous episodes that support the timelines discussed in today's episode. And now, my conversation with Jill Escher. Jill, can we start with you kind of telling us your journey into autism? And I really want to add that I've heard you say recently that, and I'll quote, "I wasn't looking for autism. Autism found me."
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s into the 80s, and I had hardly heard of autism at all. I had never met anybody with autism, even somebody who we might apply the label to today. I really can't think of anybody, you know, with traits, you know, like my kids or similar at all that I'd ever come across. Then I had three children. My husband and I have a 27-year-old young man, a 25, almost 26-year-old young man, and an 18-year-old young lady. And the latter two, the 20, almost 26-year-old man and the 18-year-old young woman, are both profoundly autistic and nonverbal. So, you know, these were very shocking, both times, very shocking diagnoses. Again, we had nothing like autism in our family histories. We didn't know people with autism. It was not something we read about, nothing we saw in the news. It was not on our radar at all. Like when I was pregnant with my sons, I mean, it just didn't even occur to me that it was something I would even think about. Like I thought, oh, you know, every, when you're pregnant, you think about, oh, maybe your kid will have Down syndrome or maybe your kid would have a birth defect or whatever. It just didn't even occur to me that, you know, autism would be a possibility. So when Johnny, who was born in 1999, was diagnosed in 2001, it was like, what are you even talking about? Like, you know, the neurologist who had assessed him when he was about 2.5, you know, saw very obviously that he had very severe classic autism, but we're like, where did that come from? And even I will say, Ryan, to this day, nobody knows where these devastating disorders came from in our son, Johnny, or our daughter, Sophie. They are idiopathic, as are the majority of cases of autism. There were no risk factors in my pregnancies. Again, nothing up our family trees to suggest that autism could be a risk. So, you know, this remains to me an abominable mystery, as it is in most cases. So that's how autism came to me. It was not something I was at all looking for. I was a lawyer at the time that I had Johnny. And I had anticipated a career in land use law. You know, I had a whole other world going on. And then this just sort of got dropped like a bomb.
Wow. How long was it after? I have a couple of questions about what you just said. But the first one is, how long was it after the birth of Johnny? Did you kind of say, you know, what is going on here? And then kind of take that role into now, what you do now.
Right. Well, the birth of Johnny, again, it was very shocking. It kind of threw our life course in a completely different direction. As happens with, I'd say, most autism families, right? You're going a certain direction. You have certain understandings about the world. You have certain expectations about what your children will be. You have certain expectations about how your family's going to operate. And then, boom, you just get flung in a completely different direction. And, at first, I think like most families, you really want to figure out what to do to help your child. That was the first priority out the bat. You're like, well, there must be something we can do about it, right? So Johnny was really a poster child for autism. I mean, when he was little, he was flapping his hands. He would always, look at little things, little objects, little corners, little intersections, in the pavement. He would chew things all the time. He couldn't talk. He didn't respond to his name. He never pointed. He never shared or showed. He was very irritable. He had trouble sleeping. He had very weird food, predilections. I mean, there's so many different things that Johnny had. It's like every check mark. Check, 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 check. He had all of them. But he was physically quite normal, except he had an abnormally large head, which again is seen in a subset of kids with autism, is abnormally large head circumference. And that persists to this day, actually. Yeah, again, really unexplained because the CT scan that was done at 12 months was abnormal, was normal. And so, of course, it remains idiopathic. But he's a normal guy, healthy guy, nothing else, nothing you would expect from a disorder, a mental disorder of this magnitude. Usually, when you have an intellectual disability of this magnitude, it's accompanied by, physical abnormalities, facial dysmorphisms, things like that. And that was not the case with Johnny. So anyway, so I got flung, in this other direction, very interested in how to help my kids. And I like most moms, I tried everything. Like I tried the diet. I tried, taking him to speech therapy. I tried taking him to occupational therapy. Tried sensory therapies. Different kinds of classes. ABA intervention programs. I mean, I didn't do like the weirder things, like hyperbaric oxygen or, some of the crazier, interventions you hear of. But nothing really seemed to move Johnny off of his trajectory at all. So that was pretty fruitless. By the time Sophie was born and she was displaying all those check marks of autism, she had some language, it was echolalic, but she didn't have any conversational language. She wasn't playing with toys, right? That's really a hallmark. When they're not playing with toys and they're not demonstrating the capacity for abstract thought, when they're not imitating and they're not sharing and showing and pointing and acquiring words, like whenever I'm with like a typical 2-year-old, I'm always astonished at what sponges they are, right? They're just taking in everything and they're learning vocabulary very rapidly. My kids, none of that. So by the time Sophie came along, we knew what was going on, and she was identified with autism by 18 months.
Such a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, this was like two kids with severe, neurodevelopmental abnormality, and again, we don't know why. So, I've really been devoting my life to pushing for answers.
My understanding is you started a couple of, correct me if I'm wrong, a nonprofit or this organization or foundation that, can you tell me a little bit about that? I know there's a couple of them actually, but
Yeah, so I've been involved with several several nonprofits. So everyone kind of fits a different bucket. So I'm very interested in research. So I have a fund, a philanthropic fund, which we call Escher Fund for Autism. And all it does is it funds pilot research studies that look at novel ideas about what might be causing autism. We also do quite a bit of advocacy for research advocacy. But I think our primary goal is to fund pilot studies. I've also published quite a bit in the scientific literature in partnership with other scientists about these questions that we explore. And I'm involved in other ways in the autism field, non-research things. For example, I'm a co-founder of the National Council on Severe Autism, and I'm past president of Autism Society, San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, yeah, it's still on the
board. Yeah, so I do a lot of, and other things too, but those are the main ones.
Okay. What are some of the highlights of the pilot study research?
Our focus, so I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware that autism is highly heritable, right? It's conjectured to be strongly genetic because it's highly heritable. So for example, if you have one child with autism, you have like a 16 to 20% chance of having a second child with autism. That's how strongly heritable it is. Not that autism really runs down ancestries. We don't see any strong evidence for that at all. It's not like, you know, great-grandparent, grandparent, yeah, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that'll happen from time to time, but that's not a strong driver of autism. Most of the heritability is seen because of the increased risk among siblings or even, you know, among half-siblings and to a slightly lesser degree. So the question is, why? What is causing this heritability? Why does autism, quote unquote, run in families like that? That is the question that we focus on. Almost all, I would say 99.9% of the attention and the funding has gone into genetics. Thinking, well, Jill has, you know, Johnny and Sophie, and they both have profound autism. So therefore, Jill and or her husband must be carrying genes that, you know, raise that risk of autism in their children, right? And that's the thinking. That's been the paradigm that has dominated autism research for, I don't know, 15 years. I would say a good 15 years. It's hunting for the genes that cause autism. Now, those genes come in two flavors. The first flavor is what they call a rare variant. And that's usually something that, like a mutation of some sort that causes some fairly severe phenotype. And we can think of lots and lots of examples of that. You can look up on the Simons Foundation gene list, you know, the 100-ish genes that are associated with autism in that way. The other flavor that the genes come in, it are what they call common variants. So they're variants that are normally harmless, and they occur in, you know, more than 5% of people. They're normally harmless, but the idea is, their theory is that those common variants can, you know, somehow conflate together to increase the risk for autism in the child. Now, there is almost no evidence for that. There is a little bit of evidence, but it's so weak that it doesn't amount to much. There's very strong evidence for rare variants causing autism in rare cases. And by the way, with those rare variants, none of them explain more than 1% of the autism. So they are indeed very rare, even in the autism world. So my kids, you know, have none of that. And most of the kids with autism and adults with autism don't have any genetic factors that are known. So I look at, well, what else is causing the heritability? If it's not the genes, where everyone else is looking, right? 99.9% of the people, they're looking at genes. I'm looking at non-genetic factors, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the interesting findings you found with the non-genetic factors?
Yeah, it's a little complex. And so I do want to kind of say at the outset that I apologize for anything that's complicated. I really try not to make things too hard because people tend to resist complex biology. It's not because they're stupid, but because it's not something they're schooled in. But the stuff I do is, I have to say, pretty advanced molecular biology. But I'll try to do my best to simplify it. All right, so everyone knows what a gene is, I think. A gene is a sequence of letters, really, sequence of bases in your DNA. They are transcribed And they are made into a protein, and that protein does something. For example, in the brain, that protein can help, you know, create a neuron or help create something that moves a neuron from one place to another, you know, in development. So the proteins have multiple functions. If something goes wrong in the gene, that means something goes wrong in the protein. That means something goes wrong in the tissue, which means something goes wrong in the organ, right? And you have some sort of disorder or condition. All right, that's pretty straightforward. That's textbook high school biology. What's not textbook high school biology is something called epigenetics or transcriptional regulation. Okay, so again, people hear these words, they get a little bit scared. Don't run away. It's not that hard. So you can have the effect of a mutation without having a mutation, i.e. all of those letters, all those base pairs in the DNA can be perfectly normal. You will have a perfectly normal, you know, scan of your genome if you're genetically tested. However, the problem is it's not just the genetic code that matters. What also matters is how those genes are expressed. What happens to them, right? How do they get transcribed? Are the genes turned off? Are the genes turned on? Are the genes turned up? Are the genes turned down? There are a whole bunch of regulatory processes around genes that affect how they are expressed. That's sometimes called epigenetics. It's actually a broader world than just epigenetics, but I'll use the word epigenetics for simplicity now. So we focus on that. What can be going wrong with the gene expression in the child that can give rise to abnormal neurodevelopment and then abnormal phenotypes like autism? And again, this is a little complex. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. There's almost, everyone says, Jill, you need like an elevator pitch. Like you need to explain this. I'm like, there's no elevator pitch. It's really complex. But you know, this, then to go back to the heritability point, things are heritable if they come basically from the sperm or the egg of the parents. Does that make sense? So I contribute an egg, my husband contributes a sperm, you know, those are the heritable components, right, that fuse and then create the child, right? And those heritable components, those what they call germ cells, contain DNA, but they contain much, much, much more than DNA. They contain all these regulatory factors, epigenetic and other regulatory factors. So this is, to me, the ultimate question in autism. What could be happening in the germ cells that influence these regulatory factors? Now, I mean, it seems like a crazy question, like, okay, here's my drink. So if I drink my, whatever this is, my lemonade or whatever, is that going to affect my germ cells? Is that then therefore going to affect my child? The answer is like, no. Most things don't affect your germ cells. Your germ cells are very well protected from damage. There's almost nothing. You know, the air you breathe isn't going to matter. You know, the food you eat for the most part isn't going to matter. You know, the amount of steps you take today isn't going to matter. But some things do matter. And I work on a couple things, but for example, here's an example of one thing that we work on, which is when you are put under general anesthesia, you are anesthetized, right? You are put into a state of basically an induced coma, essentially. You lose all sensory function and you're unconscious. It's a state of unconsciousness, it's induced unconsciousness. And, what we see, for example, in animal studies is that these general anesthetics can affect your germ cells too. So it's not just affecting your body, it's also affecting your reproductive cells. And in the animal models, when we anesthetize the rats or the mice, and then we breed them, these animals are more likely to have offspring with neurodevelopmental abnormalities and behavioral abnormalities. So it, again, it's so complex. Like I can't even believe I'm even talking to you about this, because I almost exclusively talk to scientific audiences. I don't really deal with lay audiences, except, you know, here and there. And that's because it is a very, very complicated thing. Mm-hmm. But unlike the vast majority of exposures, this is an exposure that can damage your reproductive cells, which is to say your sperm and egg and their precursors. And the offspring are at enhanced risk for having autism-like phenotypes. So we've seen this in a couple of studies. The question is, are we seeing it in humans? And the answer is, we don't know, because there hasn't been any human studies done. So what I try to do is convince researchers who are in this space that these are very important questions, that we need to look beyond the genetic sequence to look for the missing heritability of autism. It's complex, and I apologize to everybody.
I have two questions to follow up. So are you thinking that it's within the specific germ cell, or is it once they start proliferation?
Yeah, okay. Well, this is a really incredibly good question. So we are born with something called primordial germ cells. And then again, and when you're in high school biology, you learn about the process of meiosis, right? Mm-hmm. So you start with these primordial germ cells, and then the males and females completely diverge, completely, in terms of what happens in germ cell development. What happens in males is a pool of germ cells called spermatogonial stem cells kind of are right there in the gonads. And those spermatogonial stem cells are constantly churning out, or after puberty, constantly churning out sperm. So, you know, spermatids, you know, to the mature spermatozoa. But if the pool of the spermatogonial stem cells are perturbed in some way, right? Let's say that you are 3 years old, right? And you undergo surgery, and for some reason it perturbs your germ cells. Well, that, if it's not repaired, and by the way, we have really robust repair processes in the gonads, but if it's not repaired, for example, if you have like surgery after surgery after surgery after surgery, then those defects will stay in the spermatogonial stem cells and therefore translate into at least some of the mature sperm later on. So you're right to ask, because it's a long process, right? It's not like it's a one day thing, because you can have a hit when you're 2 years old or 12 years old, and that might not manifest until your child is 3 years old, which is a crazy thing to think, right? With females, we're born with all of our eggs. I think that's sort of a cliche, right? Girls are born with all their eggs, and they are, you know, pretty much. So if there's damage to the eggs that's not repaired, the pool of oocytes, you know, those could be, you know, those can carry into the next generation if it's not repaired. So yeah, it's different for the males and the females, but definitely what we've seen in the animal studies is it doesn't matter where the hit is. The hit can be when they're in the womb, like a fetus. The hit can be when they're neonates. The hit can be when they're young adults. The hit can be when they're preconception. Right? Adults. It doesn't matter that these compounds, which are highly, highly toxic, by the way, can affect the germ cells. So that's kind of scary to think that the germ cells can be affected at any point in the life cycle.
Huh.
Yeah, but again, this is only seen in animal models. Have we done a single human study? No. We do know from human studies, however, that these compounds can damage germ cells generally. We just haven't looked at the heritability part.
Some of these rats and mice, do they show like stereotypy movements like licking and their social withdrawal and so forth?
Yeah, what a good question. So I have a couple of videos linked on my website, at least two on my website. So for the super geeks who want to dive in and see each of the studies summarized, because they each look at something slightly different. There are no two studies that are exactly the same. But go to jillescher.com, ESCHER.com. I gave one at Harvard this year and UCLA, or that was 2024. Harvard, UCLA was 2023, I believe. And those I think have pretty decent amount of detail. So for the super geeks, look at those. But generally, yes, you're right. They will look at social behaviors. They will look at anxiety-like behaviors. They will look at sometimes motor behaviors. Again, everyone's different. Communication, vocalization type behaviors. It depends on what the scientist thinks is salient. Yeah, we need a lot more of them. I mean, right now we don't have it, I think there have been a total of 10 studies over time. It's just not enough. We need a lot more. So hopefully we'll see a couple more published this year, 2025.
Yeah, I'm very interested with how
When they
impactful.
look at the brain too, I should say it's not just behavior. So depending on the lab and depending on the scientist, they'll chop up the brain, right? And they'll see like, oh, has the brain developed abnormally? Or they'll look for abnormal, gene expression. They'll look for the RNAs, et cetera, which I won't get into too much, but they can look on a molecular level and a tissue level as well.
And there's some data that's
Yeah,
shown.
and there's data showing that, oh, there's, this. I mean, I don't have my notes in front of me, and
Yeah, that's fine.
sorry, my, but yeah, most definitely they see some differences in the brain of the
Yeah.
offspring.
The rodents, the rats and mice are very you can turn them autistic quite easily. I mean, I don't want to say quite easily, but it is possible.
Yeah, you can induce quote unquote, again, autism doesn't really exist in rodents. So these are just, signal behaviors. I wouldn't call them autism at all, but you can induce an autism-like phenotype in the rodents, using these exposures. Yeah.
Are your plans moving forward is to expand on those or replicate them or?
Yeah, we need more animal studies. And I really am hoping to get some human studies off the ground this year. I've already talked to two labs that are very, very interested in doing human epidemiological studies. So let's hope that, that can happen or at least start this year. These things take several years to do, these epidemiological studies, minimum 3 years.
Yeah,
For
follow them up
most of them.
the
Yeah, well, what they need a big data set with two generations. They need really robust data with two, and that's not easy to do. It's not easy. So animals and humans, we need them both. I've also funded some studies that are more molecular and in vitro. So in vitro people, what it means is basically like doing something in a test tube or in a petri dish rather than doing something in an animal. So you can take a cell culture, do something to the cell culture, an exposure, and then see the consequences of that. So I funded that too. It's a very uncharted territory. It's wide open for all kinds of approaches. It's so off the radar of mainstream research that most researchers just won't even think about going there because they're only interested in genes.
Yeah, and that's a dead-end road.
Well, I think they've already found out 99% of what they're ever going to find out in genetics. There's
Yeah.
not much more to be discovered. They're honestly, even when I talk to the geneticists, they say that too.
Yeah, but I think we'll keep going. I think I don't think the research will stop on it. It might slow down, but I don't know with the genetics.
Well, there's still so much money going into genetics. Yeah. That's who's funding. Yeah. The Simons Foundation funds almost exclusively genetics. A lot of the NIH money has gone to genetics. It's just not, you're right, it's probably not slowing down. But I think it's unfortunate because we're missing the opportunity to look at other hypotheses because, you know, genetics cannot possibly explain the incredible explosion in prevalence that we've seen in autism over the past 30 years. I mean, you know, we were talking before about prevalence data, but, you know, it's just, there's such overwhelming evidence that we've experienced a stupendous increase in autism that started with births in like the late 80s, early 90s. That was sort of the inflection point. And then from there, we've seen exponential growth in autism. Even when it's pretty strictly defined, you know, I'm not talking about like TikTok autism and, know, quirky autism, even when it's clearly and observably a disorder, we've seen those rates really climb and, you know, we're not taking it seriously enough. We're not doing anything to figure out what's causing it. We're not doing anything to really meaningfully prevent it. And I think it, honestly, it's something that could have insanely dire consequences for our country, you know, for our families, incalculably huge costs. You know, we ran some numbers based primarily on California data because California has such good birth year data on autism. And, you know, we're going to see right now, I can actually I have the numbers because I was just working on a slide. Let me find it. One second, because I'll be accurate this time. Here it is. Okay, so in California, right now we have about 8,000 cases of autism with parents, you know, above approximately age 65. Right. So these are these are parents who are elder, getting older, harder, you know, more difficult to care for their children, having more health issues, et cetera. And right now that number is about 8,000. We can project based on the current California caseload and the birth year data that number is going to be 160,000 in 30 years. Okay, so that's a 20-fold, you know, increase. It's a 20-fold increase. I mean, I can't begin to tell you what a calamity it is already with respect to these adult autism cases in California with older parents or dying parents. It's already horrible. And the system is already completely bursting at the seams. It's completely maxed out, completely. Like I just talked to a family today. They can't find a single placement for their adult son. In the entire state of California, this is not uncommon. And this is a state that has better services than most. Yet this situation will be 20-fold worse in terms of demand in 30 years. I mean, it's unbelievable to even contemplate. We have not come close to grappling with the reality that lies ahead of us. It's really horrible. But, you know, we're so caught up in this idea.
We're so caught up in the genetic studies. We spend so much.
Well, the genetic studies and the idea that, oh, you know, we're just diagnosing it more. You know, and it's that the increasing rates isn't really real. It's an artifact of awareness. It's an artifact of changing conceptions. It's not a real biological thing, which is complete nonsense. It's utter nonsense. I mean, as I said, the evidence is absolutely overwhelming for a true increase. And there is no evidence, none, zero evidence that can explain this increase through non-etiological or what do you say, non-biological, sociological effects.
I don't really like when people say that it's things like, we're diagnosing more, because even if we normalize that, it doesn't account for hardly any, especially on a significant level, of the actual increase. It might account for some, but nothing like.
No, it can't. It can. It, you know, it depends on the system. See, each system is a little bit different, right? Because you have data, for example, from developmental services. You have data from the schools. You have data from epidemiology. You have data from medical records. There's all kinds of different data, and they all use different kind of criteria, different assessment methods. So I get it. It's not super duper clean, but no matter which segment you look at, whether it's the school data or, you know, hospital records or whatever, they all show the same thing. They're all showing the exact same trends at the exact same time. It's stupendous. And there, what there is not is anything in the literature that explains it through some other mechanisms. Oh, like, for example, here's a popular one. The popular one is, oh, we are just relabeling intellectual disability, which used to be called MR, right? We are just relabeling intellectual disability as autism, right? Well, that's a nice idea, except there's no evidence for it. There might be like a little evidence over a short period of time here and there that it can explain like little wobbles.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing that can explain this overwhelming surge of autism from any other label. So it's nice that they come up with these ideas, but it's not enough to just conjecture. Show me the data.
Yeah.
I've read it. I've poured through the school data. I've poured through the developmental systems data. I've poured through the epidemiological data, not just in the US, but in, you know, 10 countries. You know, it's not... This is not subtle stuff. None of this is subtle. These are overwhelming numbers. You know, as I say, in California, 1989, we had about 3,000 cases of autism. We now have 190,000 cases of autism in the developmental system. So I'm not talking about broad spectrum. I'm talking about just the developmental services definition, the Medicaid definition.
So same data set, definition. Same data point or data set?
Yeah. So same data set, same criteria. In fact, the criteria became narrower, not broader in 2003 in California.
Hmm.
So we're talking about significant functional disability. You can't qualify to be in this system with just a label of autism. You have to have autism plus significant functional disability across three major areas of life functioning. It's serious. And the numbers are just enormous. And it's not like we can go back and find this missing horde of adults with autism that weren't found before. Those have never been found ever.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absurd and it's frustrating to have to be at this point that where we're still fighting against the myth of better diagnosis. You know, this, I think we should be well past the point of all of this. You know, past the point of doubt. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
You know, there's just no doubt.
You're increasing.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the relationship with vaccine?
I don't think there's any evidence at all to suggest that vaccines are responsible for the increase in autism.
Okay.
And that's on many levels. First of all, we don't see it in the epidemiology. So when we've done, you know, the big studies looking at, you know, large populations and, you know, people with various levels of vaccine exposure, we are not seeing any relationship between that vaccine exposure and the development of autism in children. We also don't have a molecular rationale for it. We don't have a mechanistic rationale for it. Like, why would a vaccine cause, you know, given at, let's say, 18 months or whatever, cause abnormal brain development in utero, right? Autism is by and large something that stems from abnormal brain development during the fetal period, and early life.
Yeah.
And vaccines, there's no mechanistic rationale connecting a vaccine to that biological phenomena. Yeah. So, you know, it can't explain that. it can't really explain like the timing of the increase. Like people say, oh, with the Marisol, there was some, mercury in the vaccines. Well, they took it out and autism rates kept going up and up and up.
Yeah. There's a slight lag there with the vaccine schedule and the Safety Act and then the increase. I think there's a little bit of a lag there.
Yeah, I when I've looked at the temporal associations, they just didn't make sense to me. It doesn't explain why more males are affected than females.
Yeah,
you know, it just why would it disrupt? You know, for example, this is getting into neuroscience, but you know, the GABAergic system, which is something seen in autism, it doesn't make any sense.
The EI imbalance is the data.
Yeah, the EI imbalance is really central to autism. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Bingo.
And that's the motor movements too. That explains the motor movements with the indirect pathway of the basal ganglia.
That's interesting.
And this is going to be a problem because autistics, as they get older, they're going to have a lot of autism and Parkinson's, and they're going to hit various dementias. That's going to be a problem.
There was just a study that came out looking at
AJ Drexel.
Yeah, and I only glanced at it. I haven't read it. Yeah. But, you know, for example, people with autism are at higher risk for seizures. Right. Yep. And that's because of the poor connectivity in parts of the brain. Right. Autism is mostly this connectivity problem. And so you have this electrical energy that can't be dispersed, that isn't going to where it's supposed to go. You have a buildup of excitatory activity and it results in seizures. I mean, that's a really bad, bad summary of it. But, if you have these widespread microstructural abnormalities in the brain, it stands to reason that there could be an increased risk for degeneration or late in life neurological problems. I would completely believe that.
Yeah. 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 I was wondering, as you were explaining the rodent studies and your other information on the molecular stuff, is if you found specific cells underdeveloped or migration problems in your research.
Yeah. Very, very good question. The answer is yes. So, I was talking about, for example, the example of general anesthesia. And by the way, the general anesthesia isn't the only thing that I'm concerned about. It just happens to be a focus right now because we're seeing so much plausibility via the animal models. But for example, those are agents that are well known to impair neural migration for those who are directly exposed. So let's say, you're a directly exposed neonatal rat or, fetal rat who's exposed to these compounds. We do know for sure that these can impact neural migration proper, and they can cause, basically, what are they called? Oh my God, I'm blanking. It's too late here in California. Oh my gosh. But anyway, they can basically raise the risk for seizures because the neurons end up in the wrong place and can't discharge properly. I'm sorry that I can't remember the scientific term off the top of my head. Whether this is happening in the second generation, the next generation, the answer is probably yes, because we have seen these neurological abnormalities in mouse models. So there's not enough study. We need to do a lot more study to really dig deeper and see connect all the dots.
UCLA published a paper this year, or last year now, I guess, 2024, on the abnormal connectivity with the salience network on 6 weeks old humans.
Okay.
Salience network is huge in autism.
Did I see that paper? Was it an imaging study? What was it?
I don't really recall the methods off the top of my head, but it's a very well studied paper. Lucinda Uden done it. She's a pioneer on the salience network and the insula.
I want to look that up for sure.
Yeah, and they were 6 weeks old, and then they followed them up to confirm the autistic diagnosis later in life.
Wow.
It was six. They were 6 weeks old.
But how did they do it if it wasn't imaging?
I think it was imaging, but I can't. I don't want to say for sure. But
okay. Oh, I'll have to look it up. I'm clueless. Yeah. So
I could send it to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll look it up. But you know, one thing that is really seen in quite a number of papers is this unexplained transcriptional dysregulation in early brain development. So, you know, they can see that it's happening, even if it's not caused by a genetic defect. They can see this, you know, basically, you know, abnormal RNA expression. And this has been seen in several studies. And do they know why? No, they don't know why. So to me, that's the million-dollar question in autism. What's causing that transcriptional dysregulation in early brain development?
Some sort of, are you thinking some sort of environmental signal?
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's embedded in the programming of the child via these epigenetic factors. Remember, I talked about, you know, regulatory factors in the sperm and egg that can have the effect of a mutation without being a mutation. And those things, I mean, for you're very techie people, I mean, we have one paper that's really outstanding, and basically it showed abnormal binding of transcription factors at enhancers at autism-related genes. Those transcription factors basically turned off or on genes in abnormal ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really, it's complex. They found it at many genes, and I can't tell you which is which. But you know, that should be very worrisome, right? If you have abnormal binding of transcription factors, you're bound to have abnormal expression of the genes, and then, you know, possibly an abnormality in brain development.
Yeah, it's just a domino effect.
Yeah. And those were caused by a general anesthetic exposure. So yeah, it's complex. And I like, you know, I should have brought I didn't know we were going to talk so much science, but you know, I would have brought out all my notes because I always get the genes wrong.
I didn't either, but I'm glad we did because I prefer that. There's a lot
well,
of
watch my Harvard talk because I think that one will get into enough of the details.
And a lot of them are centered around proteins that are responsible for excitation, which would mm-hmm. cause the EI imbalance even more.
Mm-hmm.
So excitation and then the GABA being low
mm-hmm.
and cellular functioning and synaptic functioning too.
Yeah.
The pre and post synaptic. There's a lot of stuff there, which mm-hmm. which all makes sense downstream for the autistic phenotype.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think so. I definitely think so. These are acting on genes that are associated with neural development and neural functioning.
Last question, and I'll let you go, mm-hmm. I guess. I'm loving this conversation.
I bored you to death. I bored your poor listeners to death.
No. It kind of fits in line with my episode, so I don't think it's a worry. What's the biggest barrier for you in your research right now? Or the biggest barriers, plural? The
biggest barrier is dogma. The biggest barrier is dogma. And there's two dogma that are really problematic. The first dogma is the genetics dogma.
Yeah.
You know, they have to expand the way they think about heritability. Full stop. Full stop.
Yeah.
They have to just be willing to ask new questions. And so far, that field is not willing to move. And so that's the first dogma problem. The second dogma problem comes via the neurodiversity movement because of their fanaticism. And I will say fanaticism about the idea that autism is perfectly natural and it's just a normal way of being. And we're just appreciating it now. We're just noticing it now. And it just has to be accepted and it shouldn't be treated. And it's not something we should worry about. And you know, the problem is with society. The problem isn't with the brain. You know, that is just dumb. It's just stupid. While I definitely appreciate efforts to promote inclusion and support and services, I'm completely on board 100% with all of that. we don't have to pretend, you know, that autism is, you know, just a variant of normal. We don't have to normalize autism to get there. We don't. So, you know, those are the two biggest barriers right now. And I do think there's a third barrier, which is we were really burned by the vaccine hypothesis. And no one wants to make that mistake again. Nobody wants to start blaming autism on something erroneous. And I get that. So I think people are very ultra cautious about introducing any new ideas. The problem is we are now seeing more than 3% of US children having autism. And it is a huge, massive national emergency, beyond national emergency. So I don't care if you're uncomfortable. I get that the vaccine hypothesis was a debacle. Like, I get it. I've been fighting that for a long, I've been fighting that battle too. But we have to roll up our sleeves and do the serious work. Right now, autism is just an unserious area. It's just unserious. It's become silly. And we have to move away from that and in a new direction. So it's hard. We're in a very hard place now. And I just do my best to try to convince people to think out of the box.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I couldn't agree more with you. Hopefully there will be a little bit of changes on the direction moving forward.
Well,
research.
Let's hope. Yeah. Maybe someone will hear this podcast and go, you know.
Genetics is a dead end, but they're going to
go. Yeah, let's ask some new questions.
Well, Jill, thank you so much. And you mentioned it earlier, but give us a couple of ways that we can contact or look into your research. And you mentioned your website.
The easiest thing is I have a website where I just, you know, plop down the links to various things I've written or, you know, spoken at, but it's a Jill Escher, one word, JILLESCHER.com. And my contact is there, but it's jill.escher@gmail.com.
Okay. So,
I'm grateful for the opportunity, and I really appreciate the fact that you have so much curiosity about, autism etiology, and so willing to ask, you know, new questions. That's exactly what we need.
Yeah, it happens sometime along this timeline of the mother, father, placenta, womb, through pregnancy. And couldn't agree more.
Yeah, it's a developmental quirk that has an origin, right? It's not like random. My argument is we have to look for what's originating, you know, these perturbations of development. So hopefully we'll get there.
Hopefully we can have a part two and talk more science.
Yeah, I'll be more prepared next time. You know, after I haven't read a study for a couple months, you know, the details go to mush, but I will definitely, you know, be prepared with much more science next time, I promise.
I was pleased that we went there.
Thanks, all right.
Have a good day.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
If you're listening to the podcast or listening to the episode, please feel free to leave a review or ratings. In podcasting, review and ratings are crucial, and I very much appreciate your feedback. You can contact me on X at RPS47586 or click on the Hop link so you can have links to all the show platforms and contact information. You can email me info.fromthespectrum@gmail.com. And thank you for listening to From the Spectrum Podcast.